This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Tuesday, February 2nd. I'm Angela Denning. The Petersburg Assembly yesterday decided to table an item asking the legislature to reappropriate state money earmarked for building a road between Petersburg and Kayak. There is about $37 million left of the $40 million project after planning for the road has gone forward over the last 4 years. A few members of the public, Mike Stainbrook and Karen McCullough, spoke in favor of moving the money into other projects. Here's Mike Stainbrook.
I also realize that it's important to consider the city of Kuprinoff and the city of Kayak in this process. I'm hoping it can be a win-win for all three communities and the state.
McCullough said she would also like the money to go to other projects that would benefit Petersburg and Kayak and wouldn't interfere with the city of Kuprinoff, which has voiced opposition to the road.
I'm really in favor of doing whatever we can to help Kayak get electricity, and if giving, you know, if trying to get a fair amount of that money redirected to Kayak, I would personally be in favor of it.
However, the Assembly wasn't sure if the timing was right to ask the legislature about the issue. The state is looking for cuts, lots of cuts. Assemblyman Jay Stanton Greger.
Given the legislative climate, I think right now we run significant risks of jeopardizing that money for Petersburg Borough, Kayak, etc. in any form if the issue is pushed at this point, and I would advocate for maybe revisiting the issue at a later date when potentially the political climate is a little more favorable towards Petersburg, Kayak, etc.
The Assembly decided not to take up the idea of a possible reappropriation until a later time. We'll hear more about yesterday's Assembly meeting in KFSK News this week. Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott released the second draft of an agreement between Alaska and British Columbia meant to protect transboundary rivers from mines and other development. Mine critics say it's an improvement on the first draft, but the agreement still isn't strong enough on its own. KSTK's Katerina Sestarek has more from Wrangell.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott sent the second draft of a statement of cooperation to British Columbia officials as part of an ongoing effort to preserve water quality and fisheries of the Stikine, Taku, Unik, and Alsek rivers. Mallott says although the statement of cooperation is legally non-binding, it will build agreements and understanding between Alaska and BC to ensure water quality in transboundary rivers is maintained.
So long as there is a permitting process underway in British Columbia that could affect the water quality, the environmental integrity of any of the river systems, the state of Alaska, in our judgment, has an obligation to be fully engaged with British Columbia to protect our interests, and that is the bottom line.
The agreement would create a working group including the commissioners of the Departments of Fish and Game, Environmental Conservation, and Natural Resources, as well as the British Columbian Deputy Ministers of the Environment and Energy and Mines. It describes public participation on both sides of the border in the assessment and permitting of new mines and information sharing between the state, the province, and the public. After consulting with a citizens' advisory group on transboundary mining, Mallott incorporated comments from stakeholders into the agreement.
I think the biggest improvement is the fact that the draft statement of cooperation really recognizes that the statement of cooperation itself can only do so much, and that the Boundary Waters Treaty and its associated International Joint Commission, the IJC, may very well be a necessary next step.
That's Chris Zimmer of Rivers Without Borders. He says the statement of cooperation can be valuable, but only if it's combined with the IJC. The Boundary Waters Treaty and its International Joint Commission address cross-border water issues between Canada and the U.S. Zimmer says the IJC is probably the only path to a binding, enforceable agreement.
While we would have liked to see stronger support outright for an IJC there and have the state directly request that of the State Department, I still think what we're seeing in this statement of cooperation is probably the strongest statement of support for the IJC we've seen from the state.
The first draft of the agreement didn't mention the International Joint Commission. The second draft states that by entering the Statement of Cooperation, Alaska and British Columbia are not precluded from seeking a referral to the International Joint Commission. Mallott says he's fully engaged with the IJC issue, and he doesn't think it will affect the pending agreement with BC at this time.
I've had conversations with the state, our State Department, with the Canadian government, the U.S. IJC secretary. We are in the process of finalizing a letter to the State Department, which will ask a series of questions about the IJC and what the IJC may or may not do.
Fred Olson of the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Workgroup says getting the federal governments of both countries involved is especially important for Native tribes in the area. He says it's an international issue.
The United States government has a fiduciary trust responsibility for the tribe, and without the federal government involved, we're kind of left out. You know, the tribes are on the outside looking in. This agreement, the Statement of Cooperation, it talks about enhanced participation by tribes, and, you know, I'm not sure what that means.
Some mine critics are also calling for a formal public comment and hearing process as part of developing the Statement of Cooperation. Malott says public participation will continue to be carried out informally, but he wants to engage with all stakeholders.
We would hope that all of the various interests themselves form and build relationships in whatever way that they deem necessary, and we will be responsive to pretty much anything that is put before us, and we ourselves will be constantly reaching out and being open and transparent.
Malott says British Columbia will probably take a few months to review the new draft Statement of Cooperation. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Katerina Sestarek.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott signed the state marijuana regulations into law last month, on the 22nd of January, and the state will begin accepting license applications February 24th. But there's a wrench in the works. The original bill fails to properly authorize background checks. Emily Kwong has more on this from Sitka.
Before the Marijuana Control Board can issue licenses to anybody, the FBI requires a background check. It's a way of determining if an applicant has received a felony conviction in the last 5 years in another state. If the answer is yes, no license may be awarded. But the original bill is missing the enabling language that would allow the FBI to run names and fingerprints in the first place. Cynthia Franklin, the director of the Marijuana Control Board, says that in order to award that power, it will take a state statute.
The FBI requires an enabling statute to run a name through the National Criminal History Database, and a regulation is not enough.
The Alaska Department of Public Safety notified the Marijuana Control Board of this oversight in October. She explains the language should have been inserted into HB 123, which created the Marijuana Control Board. It was brought up as a floor amendment, but ultimately didn't make it in.
So it was discovered well after session. So they missed a spot.
Furthermore, the Department of Public Safety is missing its necessary authorization to do background checks, as it does for liquor licenses. Franklin says that in order for licenses to be issued in June, the legislature must fill these legal loopholes fast.
And if those things do not happen this session, then we will be in a very sticky place, because we will have a statute that says we can't issue licenses to individuals who have a felony conviction within the last 5 years, but we will only be able to check Alaska criminal histories. We will not be able to check out-of-state criminal histories. So we may have someone say, yeah, I don't have any felony convictions in the last 5 years, but we won't have any way of knowing whether that's a true statement or not.
To close this security gap, the Senate Rules Committee is interested in rewriting HB 75, a marijuana cleanup bill from last session, and folding in the necessary statutory language. The bill was originally drafted in the House Community and Regional Affairs Standing Committee, chaired by Representative Kathy Tilton. An aide for Tilton, Heath Hilliard, told KCAW by email that the Senate is on their own timeline, but that the bill may see movement on the floor next week. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
The Sitka Tribe of Alaska is awaiting a $2.8 million check, the result of a historic class action lawsuit against the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The case cleared the last court hurdle last week. It settles decades of underpayment on contracts for tribes running BIA programs. All told, 340 tribes will be compensated $940 million, divvied up in various amounts. Mike Baines, chairman of the Sitka Tribe of Alaska, is pleased that justice was served.
I think there's a long history of the government kind of mismanaging, you know, land and other assets that tribes have had over the years, and I'm pretty glad that it's this part of getting settled, at least.
He adds that STA was expecting more money from the settlement. The Tlingit and Haida Central Council, for example, is set to receive $11.4 million. Overall, Alaskan Native groups will receive over $100 million. Currently, Bain says the tribe is in careful discussion about how its $2.8 million will be managed. Finance Director Barry Fowler suggested creating a trust fund. Bain said the tribe may also use it for repairs to infrastructure or as seed money for economic development.
This money is important because grant money is just drying up pretty much, and with less grant money available, there's more and more competition from other tribes, and so this settlement will help a lot, I think, for our tribal citizens.
Southeast's share represents roughly 2% of the $940 million to be paid out nationwide. The organized village of Cake is slated to receive $1.2 million. The Yakutat Tlingit Tribe and Huna Indian Association are listed for roughly $768,000 each, and the Angoon Community Association for $16,000. Two Ketchikan elders are cleaning up and looking for a new place to live after the roof of their rented home was blown off during a big storm last week. KRBD's Layla Carey talked to the couple about the experience and has this story.
Marge and Frank James were in bed, not quite asleep after a restless, stormy night. It was past 1 a.m., and Frank James says the light suddenly went out, and then Marge heard thunder.
It's not thunder. It's something else bouncing across the roof.
Actually, it was the roof, or the top portion of it anyway. It peeled off the house during a particularly strong gust. The couple was immediately inundated with water.
Must be over 50 spots in the bedroom. There's master bedroom where it was pouring down. I mean, literally pouring, not dripping, pouring, and running down the walls.
The Jameses quickly took action, but they're both elders, and Frank is recovering from heart surgery along with other health issues.
You know, this two of us are not supposed to left, and I'm not supposed to left, period. So, but, you know, I never listen anyway, but, yeah. But it was a big nightmare.
They did what they could to move items from the wettest part of the house into the living room, which remained relatively protected, and they worked to minimize the water damage.
We had pots and pans. We ran out of pots and pans all over. Pretty soon we had to put rain gear on.
At around 6 a.m., the couple decided it was time to call in the kids and grandkids to help. The family mobilized to move the heavy furniture, and the landlord later sent a crew over to put a tarp over the exposed single-story house. Several days after the storm, the rooms where the leaks were the worst are cleared out, with nearly everything piled into the living room area. The house is chilly, and there's a damp smell that's not too strong now, but indicates how bad the leaking was.
No, it was horrible. I told everybody when they came in, they always usually take their shoes off, and they automatically start talking out, and you put them on coming in here and take them off going outside.
The focus now is on cleanup. Marge James says she's going to be doing laundry constantly for days.
Because the walls in the closet in our room, which is on the other side of that wall, water was coming into the closets, everything hanging on the shelves in there, wet.
At least clothes can be cleaned. In another room, Frank James says he found some worse damage.
And then I finally went and checked the office, and here all my electronics were soaked down, every bit of them. And I got a $2,400 model boat in there, and that was soaked.
The model boat is a remote-controlled electronic boat. There also was a lot of legal paperwork that had been stored in the office that needs to dry out. And a couple of real boats out in the yard were hit with pieces of the roof as it broke up and scattered. Right now, Marge and Frank are staying at a local hotel with funding assistance from Ketchikan Indian Community, but they're looking for a new place to live.
No, we're just trying to get some place to move into because we can't stay in this, you know. And like I said to him this morning, those carpets haven't hit badly yet, but the smell is going to be atrocious.
Frank, who has building experience, says it's going to take several months at least to get the house into a livable condition again. The couple also will need to replace some household items. Luckily, most of their memorabilia and heritage items were in the living room.
When I see a cedar hat, did you lose anything irreplaceable like that?
No, because most of that kind of thing is in here, as a rule. Like the pictures, they so far they look good.
Yeah, I've got cedar hats in the other room, but none of them are.
They're okay.
They're okay.
Well, actually, I guess those are kind of built to be wet.
Oh yeah, yeah. They're 50-year lifespan, just laying in the mud.
While the couple did not have renter's insurance, they said they didn't need any help other than a new place to move into. But their daughter, Colleen James Olson, says they're just too proud to accept donations. James Olson says she's working with Tlingit Haida Regional Housing Authority in hopes of getting expedited acceptance for her parents into the Sean Heady Senior Housing Facility in Saxman. Her parents can't stay with her because of pet allergies, so James Olson says while they wait to hear from Tlingit Haida, the family is looking for short-term housing options. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And I'm Angela Denning. This wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine. Thanks for listening. Coming up on KFSK, the weather forecast is next, as well as community announcements. Then, Straight Beat with Ross Nanek III. At 2:35 this afternoon, KFSK's Sideline Sports. At 2:40, High Country with Dave Israelson. At 4 p.m., it's NPR's All Things Considered. Another local newscast at 4:30. At 6 p.m., news from around the state with Alaska News Nightly. At 6:30 tonight, Ebb Tide with Steve Barry. 9 o'clock, The Thistle and Shamrock. At 10 o'clock tonight, Radio Free Petersburg with Eric LeDuc. And then at midnight, the BBC World Service live from London.